Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming. First, I want to thank Dr. Shira Katz and Phil Setnick and Kim Setnick for sponsoring this whole breakfast here that we're enjoying this morning in honor of Shira's father, Shmuel Yaakov and Yeshaya, I believe. And Phil's father. Yeshaya ben Shmuel Yaakov. There we go. I know your brother, Shmuel Yaakov ben Yeshaya, so the Yeshaya ben Shmuel Yaakov, yes. And Meir ben Getzel, that's Phil's father. And the last one we had was a few months ago, sponsored by the Mullers, and it was a big hit then. And the idea of just being able to ask a question freely without fear of repercussions or something that might not come up in an ordinary kind of Shaila kind of way. So on Shir and Phil's suggestion, we decided that we should take questions ahead of time, whether by email or phone call, or people submitted some questions in writing. So I'll tackle some of those. People have questions from the floor, and that is also, time permitting, that will be welcome as well. So we'll get started over here. Ask a question that everyone has been asking lately, and I'll read up the question here. Can halachic decisions be made with the help of AI, with AI-deduced chidushim, meaning ideas that the AI programs come up with, based on computer analysis of collected writings? So I'll tell you, there has been a tremendous amount of discussion everywhere over the course of the last few months. I've had Rabbanim ask me, what's this thing with robots taking over the world? You know, and people, and I was told recently that a major yeshiva, a major American yeshiva, was at some sort of conference, a Jewish educators conference, where this was also brought up, and he was warning the Talmidim in the yeshiva to be careful and not to consult with AI. There was a kol kore, a public pronouncement, made by the rabbis of the square community in New York, warning, and Montreal, warning people about AI. And I've dabbled in it, I've checked it out, the main website. There's OpenAI, there's a thing called ChatGPT. These have been coming up in discussions, and I really didn't understand, to me, at first, I'll answer the question, but I want to tell you why I think it's much ado about nothing, at least at this point. Here's the issue. This ChatGPT, the AI ability to answer questions that has come out lately, and if you tried it, but just by throwing in some, you know, random questions to it, it's more than just Rabbi Google, right? I mean, you understand, it's not just that you put a question in a search engine and you get some sort of generic selection of answers. This AI is a technology that somehow puts everything that it sees from all over the internet and collates it and comes up with a response that seems intelligent in a matter of seconds. Just to give you an example of something that I played with 2 weeks ago, I asked the program, I said, write me a poem about Chabad Hasidic philosophy in the style of Dr. Seuss. And it did it, I'll tell you. It was quite a clever poem. It put all these things together, and in a matter of seconds, it was like as good as any hop on pop or anything like that. It all came out about Chabad Hasidus. I just threw that out there.
Please post it on the website.
You can check it yourself. You'll see. It will.
Podcast notes.
Sorry?
Podcast notes.
In podcast notes, yes. We'll put it up there. Sorry?
Hop on pop.
Hop on pop. Very good. Excellent. Beautiful. So, it can answer questions. Here's the thing. I'll tell you. By telling you why I don't think it's a big deal, I'll tell you why people are afraid of it. I was asked about a month or two ago by someone I know online. He said, we were having a phone call of sorts, and he said, I want to write a quiz, like a test, on Jewish history. And I need someone because I'm not knowledgeable enough to know if the answers are correct or not. Please help me out with this. So I said, sure. He said, I'm going to ask the AI program to write me a 10-question test on Jewish history and philosophy. And I want you to help me and let me know if the answers it provides are correct. and it will grade me. So you can literally say, ask the program, give me a 10-question test on Jewish history and philosophy. And again, in a matter of a couple of seconds, it produces it. You can ask it to provide you multiple choice or not. It provided all the questions. And here's the first question, and this will be a perfect demonstration of the genius of GPT and the utter idiocy of ChatGPT. And why you have to know that they're both true. The question was, what is the name of the Jewish text of oral law that was composed in the 2nd century? And what are its 2 main sections? It's a 2-part question. So the answer to the first part, based that it said it's the 2nd century, I said it's the Mishnah. The Mishnah was composed in the late 2nd century by Rabbi Yehuda Anasi. It's the late 2nd century. The problem I was stuck with, as my friend was reading me the question, is what are its 2 main sections? So I suspected there was a mistake. Because usually when people speak about Torah Shabbat Peh, the oral law, they might refer to the Mishnah and the Gemara. But the Gemara was not composed in the 2nd century. The Gemara was put together in its final edit in the 6th century. So I didn't know. So I said, I don't know what it's looking for. So let's see. So they said they're giving you partial credit, like the AI grades the test as well. So partial credit because you got the first part correct. The answer is Mishnah. But you didn't get the second answer, the second part. What are the 2 main parts of the Mishnah? Zeraim and Moed. So a little bit of background. If you stay up late at the Seder, then you know there are Shisha Sidrei Mishnah. 6 orders of the Mishnah. They have names. Zeraim, Moed, Nashim, Nezikin, Kachim, Taros. Those are the 6 orders of the Mishnah. ChatGPT, the AI, searched the entire internet and came up with an answer, somehow understanding that in the orders of the Mishnah, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe as they were reading the English, orders, so the 2 main sections are 1 and 2. You see? Like, if I list something in order of importance, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, what are the main ones? The first two. I'm sure that's what happened in AI's brain. And we went on, and on every question, it was a 10-question test, on every question where it was a matter of 2 parts, and they decided this was a clever method of writing a test, and it is, the first part and the second part of the question, they got the second part involved some sort of conjecture of some kind, and they got it wrong every single time. On various questions, not, it wasn't just about Mishnah, everything of Jewish history and philosophy the last 2,000 years, 10 questions, right? Pick 10 questions about Jewish history the last 2,000 years. Error after error after error. This is why you don't, at least at this point, you don't have to be afraid of it. However, what the concern that people have, which is valid, is that it is progressively getting smarter. Meaning there are people, part of the job of people who have been testing it out over the last few months is to tell it, you are wrong. You know, this is the correct answer. And then it, with its politeness algorithm, says, oh, I apologize for the error. Thank you for helping me, and so on. And then it tells you, but then even then, it might improve, but I've seen people do this. What is 2 plus 2? 4. You're wrong. The answer is 5. My apologies. You know, the 2 plus 2. And you, so games are played like this. If you understand what I just said about, like I said, the stupidity of the program, by the way, not real stupidity, but just the ability of not being able to put it together to understand what it's reading, the insulting term for this, and I apologize to those listening on the recording, but live you'll understand what I mean, is that AI has a goyish cup. Meaning it's like it has all the information, it has all the history available to it, but there's just something missing in terms of the application to be able to make sense, you know, even though it's an IQ of 1,000,000. But to put it together, it lacks entirely. And I think it will continue to lack it for decades to come because it can't put that piece together no matter how smart it is. Because after all, I'll tell you, because I've searched things all over, Everything is on the internet, meaning as far as the texts. The texts are on the internet. If it's still not able to put it together, then there's something lacking in that specific Jewish or rabbinic intelligence. So it can be helpful, but as long as you realize that it just doesn't have the brains to really put it together, I think we're all going to be safe. So you might be able to, if you're curious about different opinions, someone can throw out a question in there, out there to it, and you'll get some choices. As long as you understand there's a considerable chance that the answer is wrong, then you'll be fine. All right. Here's a question on yesterday's parsha, and I will answer this question while I answer another question as well. Yesterday we had Parshas Chukas Balak, so we had in Parshas Chukas, Moshe Rabbeinu is told to take the staff and then to go and to give the people water, and then he is told after the incident that because he and Aaron did something wrong, they cannot go into Eretz Yisrael because they did not sanctify God's name. It's a difficult parsha. Any answer is unsatisfying. But even in the unsatisfying nature of the answer, we hope for something. It might not be fully satisfying, but give me something. And over the centuries, rabbis have come up with different ways of understanding it, because understandably, the Torah itself is opaque about it. They never really spell out what Moshe did wrong, which is what lead the rabbis over the centuries to try to find something. But there are two questions that stand out, and that I'm going to mention now because they were asked, I guess, because of last week's parsha. The one question was that if you take a look at the story initially, Hashem tells Moshe, at the beginning of the story, when Moshe says there's a problem, Hashem tells Moshe, take the staff and go before the people and bring water out of the rock. Speak to the rock. So now the question is, if he was told to take the staff, so why is it that the rabbis fault him for hitting the rock? They told him, take the stick. What else was he supposed to do with the stick? Take the stick and speak to the people, speak to the rock. So, like, speak to the rock, he's supposed to speak to the rock, but he hit the rock, but he was told to take the staff. The second question, which is not really related, but it's part of the complexity of the story, is that when you read the story, you see that Aaron is punished as well. You have to wonder, what did Aaron do wrong here? He doesn't seem to have been party to this at all. So there are many other questions going to be asked about it, but I'll just tackle those two since they're fresh in everyone's mind. First of all, why did Moshe take the staff? You have to understand what's happening over here. Take a look at the story. I don't have a Chumash now open in front of me, but when you look at the story in the Chumash, you'll realize this right away, which is that, what do you mean take the staff? We all know that Moshe has a staff. We've heard about this matha that Moshe has all the way since Parshas Shmos. He has the staff. He uses it again and again. But the staff, the stick, the matha that is mentioned in Parshas Chukas, it then says Moshe took the stick from before Hashem. Now, what is this that you had? This has to give you pause. Was Moshe storing his staff in the Kodesh Kodashim? Like, it sounds strange. Like, he couldn't put it in his closet. You know, like, what does it mean? He took the staff from before Hashem. So what you realize, and this involves just a little bit of memory, there was a staff that was placed before Hashem in Parshas Korach. It says when the people were upset about Korach's death and everything that the Korach's people went through, they were angry at Moshe. So first there was a plague that was cured with Aaron going with the incense. And then there was this other story having to do with the leader of all the tribes bringing a stick. And Aaron would bring a stick with Shevet with Levi on it, with his name for Shevet Levi. And they went in the Kodesh Kodashim. And then Aaron's staff sprouted almonds, buds, blossoms, and almonds. And then Hashem tells Moshe, after that story, keep that stick and place it in front of the Aron, the Os Libnei Meri, and this will be a sign for rebellious people in the future. Which means that's the stick that was used in Parshas Chukas. So what we have here, this must have looked funny, Moshe had two staffs. There was the staff that he always had, that's mentioned, goes back to Parshas Shmos. What Hashem told him to do as the solution was take the staff that's in the Kodesh Kodashim, that is meant to be the symbolic reminder of to the Jews not to rebel, take that staff and show it to them. Which is why Moshe says, Shimu Naham Orim, listen up now, you rebels. How did he know to call them rebels? So people mistakenly think, well, he lost his temper. No, the fact that Hashem told him to take the staff that is meant for rebels, what he's saying is, Hashem told me that you're really misbehaving right now. How do I know that? Because he told me to take the stick to show people who are morim, who are rebels. And that's why I have the stick. That is not the stick that he hit the rock with. That was just show and tell. That was, look here, remember this from the Korach incident? This is the way I remind you that you are being rebellious right now. That's all. Then he hit with his staff, and then you can get into complexity of why that was considered a problem if he was asked to speak. I think on a basic level, which is, again, a little unsatisfying, so I apologize if you're not fully convinced, because neither am I, but I'll just mention it, which is that the lesson ultimately is something that I think all parents know, and all teachers know, even though it's no longer done in schools, which is, if you can accomplish something by using words rather than using physical force, then you have made your point deeper and more satisfying, and it sinks in. And this is true of everything. This is not only true of, let's say, you know, spanking your child instead of just saying something, which is also true, but it's true, or like in the olden days where the cheder teacher would take his ruler and, you know, rap the kids on their knuckles, you know, that kind of thing. Whenever you can speak with someone, to someone, you are accomplishing more than when you hit them. I'll tell you just, by the way, I try every week when I review the Parsha to review it with onklos. Onklos is the Aramaic translation of the Torah. It's become less and less popular over the centuries that people don't know Aramaic as a language, but it helps actually to learn Aramaic, which is useful when learning a lot. Vaydaber Hashem im el Moshe lemor is one of the most common verses we have in the Torah. Vaydaber Hashem el Moshe lemor. God spoke to Moses, saying, in Aramaic, umalil Hashem im Moshe lemeimar. God spoke with Moshe, which is a tremendous insight. Even when you are talking to someone, you're talking with them. You are having a conversation with them. Even if the person doesn't answer back once, the fact that the person is listening means you are having a conversation with them. You are not only talking to them. So that is the power of the meaning of speaking as opposed to hitting. And the staff was not meant to be an indication that you should hit the rock. It was meant to be an indication. This will be the format with which you address them is remind them by having the stick as a conversational tool, not as something you should hit something with.
Really?
Then, yes, I'm going to answer your question.
Yeah.
What?
So, because it was the staff from Parshat Korach, it wasn't even, because a lot of times when you read about this, they talk about the fact that if you hit the rock last time before with the staff. So
right.
It wasn't even the same staff.
It was not the same staff. In Parshas Beshalach, the first time you have the water issues, when they came out of Egypt, Mitzrayim, the first time, you didn't have the Korach staff yet. That whole story hadn't happened. There, the staff was clearly only he came in with his regular, you know, staff. Now, as to Aaron, this is part of it. We sometimes forget that Aaron has a job. Not just the job of Kohen Gadol, which he was promoted a while ago. So we've been thinking about Aaron as Kohen Gadol all the way back to Parshas Tetzaveh. But Aaron was given a job initially, and that job was never taken away. He's a speaker. He's the spokesman. Aaron has been the spokesman for Moshe Rabbeinu since the beginning. He never quit that job. He now is Kohen Gadol as well. Every time Moshe speaks, Aaron is Moshe's spokesman. So when he was told to go with Aaron, he was told, he said, go and then speak to the rock, about the rock, however you read it, told to speak, Aaron would have been the spokesman, the speaker right then. But then what happened? Moshe hit the rock. Aaron somehow, and again, unsatisfying, I understand, Aaron was meant to take on the role and to be a spokesman. And what happened in one manner or another, I don't know how I would play this out if I was directing the scene, is that Aaron was meant to speak. Moshe comes, though. Aaron's standing by, you know, to be the miturgaman, as we say. Yet what does Moshe do? He speaks, and then he hits. And Aaron's like, am I supposed to say something now? Meaning, you know, what am I supposed to say? And Aaron then, but Aaron says nothing. And because Aaron says nothing, even though Aaron should say something, that's Aaron's job to say something. What should he have said? I don't know. That's an interesting thing to theorize about. Maybe he should have said, this is what Moshe meant by hitting the rock. Or maybe, but he should have said something. He was there because he's asked to speak. Hashem said, I'm asking you to come up on the stage and to speak. And Aaron did not speak. And that was, to whatever level that we can never understand these stories, the fault or the lack in what Aaron did. So that this, the insight into speaking is a way to answer really both of these questions.
Probably maybe like Eov Shasak was the problem.
Job is described by the rabbis as being one of Paro's advisors in Egypt, and he didn't say anything. Sometimes when you're supposed to speak and you don't, you know, then there's an issue. All right, any questions from the floor before? Yes?
Speaking of favor and getting your bundles wrapped by a rule.
Right.
News about Hasidic schools in New York, which got front page coverage yesterday in the New York Times for being out of compliance, perhaps illegal. It's not a new story.
About what? About
the Hasidic schools in New York City and how they're not preparing students. It's been a big political issue in New York for a while.
Yeah, the New York Times the question, if they didn't hear on the recording, is that the New York Times and, you know, some parts of the, you know, state of New York government have been highly critical of the Hasidic school system in parts of New York, especially over the last couple of months, but also over the last few years, really. And so this is an issue that has come up freshly. New York Times brings it up, you know, every so often. And it's been a very, an issue of great tension, you know, in the media and among Jews over the last couple of months especially. How do I tackle that? I'll tackle it by asking another question. One of the questions here that I was going to save for later. And it's a valid question. It could be tense, but I'll tackle what I think are the important parts of it. The question is, and the people might have experience with this here where we live, if a city says a shul cannot operate, can one daven there? So I didn't want to take that question, but I'll connect it with your question. You can probably see the connection. So people, first of all, I'll say this.
No, they have to come here to daven.
They have to daven at Heist Jewer Center. They shouldn't, right. Second of all, there is a principle that you have, many Jews have been quoting over the course of the last few decades, and they quote it in a broad, expansive way. Halacha never understood it that broadly, but it's used very often. Dina de Malchusa Dina. People hear this phrase thrown about all the time. The law of the kingdom is the law. Dina de Malchusa Dina. So people translate that, or effectively interpret that, as meaning you have to follow the law of the country or the jurisdiction you're in. You always have to follow the law. The law is the law. Even though it's not a halacha, but if the kingdom makes that law, then it means you have to follow the law. I think that's how most people read that line. So first of all, I'll tell you the actual source for that halacha is a principle that's found in Tanakh, in Sefer Shmuel, when talking about the powers that the king would have. When people ask Shmuel, the prophet Samuel, to give them a king, and he lists, you know, this is what the king is going to be able to do to you, and he gives a whole list of things, then that is called Mishpat HaMelech. However, when it comes to codes of Jewish law, I'll mention the Rambam specifically. Where would you think the Rambam talks about the halachos of Dina de Malchus Adina? He brings them up in his section called Hilchos Gezela, the laws of theft. In what way does theft relate to this? So the Rambam effectively says, when even though Gezela is not allowed, right? You're not allowed to steal from people. When the government takes your money, that's not theft. Even though they're taking it against your will, and that's the classical definition of theft, of gezela, is, hey, that's mine. I don't care. I grab it from you. That's called gezela. The Rambam says, when the government does it, it's not gezela. They're allowed to take your money. Taxation is not theft, unlike the libertarian slogans. Right? Taxation, this is literally what the Rambam is saying there in Hilchos Gezela. Taxation is not theft, which means the government has the right, because of its responsibilities to maintain order, to take your stuff. How much? As much as it deems appropriate, and not based on any democratic principles, because there were no democratic principles in the Rambam's world, or in the world of the Gemara, you know, until, 1800, or late 1700s. So now, what this means is they have the right to take your stuff. Now, does this mean that they can just say anything they want at any time about anything you do? No. It means they have the right to fine you or penalize you if they don't like what you're doing, or even if they do like what you're doing, but they want to take your money. That's what Dina de Malchusa Dina actually means. Which means, if they ask you for something, you need to give them, meaning they have the authority. Here's where it gets complicated in many jurisdictions, and this was true of many, many rules. I'll tell you, this was one application of Dina Malchus Adina, can be seen in many of the government's COVID restrictions. And it's my least favorite topic in the world, so COVID. So I don't, but I'll just mention one detail of it that I think is important. And then with the schools that came up, and then with the shuls in all over the United States and other places as well. You had in Russia, communist Russia, the operating of chadarim, meaning Jewish schools, yeshivas, and the operating of shuls was forbidden by government decree all over Russia. In fact, today is the 13th of Tammuz. 13th of Tammuz is when the 6th Lubavitcher Rebbe was released from prison in 1927 after he had been arrested. He had been for about 4 weeks. They were going to kill him. They were going to kill him. He had chadarim operating all over Russia. He had shuls open all over Russia. The Russian government forbade them. He kept them open and was funding them and doing things that the Russian government did not, the Soviet government did not want. And they were going to kill him, and it was only because of some very fortuitous events of people letting Latvian government officials and American government officials know that the Russian government decided it wouldn't be worth executing him. And then first they were going to send him to exile in like a faraway Russian city, Kostroma. And then after a week, they decided to give up on that as well. And they just freed him entirely. And they say, well, that's different. That's communists. Hold on. A government is a government. So now the question is not so much if a law is fair or not, but if they have the right. The main issue of Dina Malchus Adina is, do they have the right to penalize you or not? Do they have the right to fine you or tax you for any infraction? So the answer is yes, they do have the right to penalize you. It's not considered gezela. However, a principle of Dina de Malchus Adina is that if it's not coming from the Malchus, but from the capriciousness of a particular government authority, and that's the way that the law or regulation is enforced, then a Jew does not have to submit to that. If they catch you, they catch you. But if it's being enforced capriciously, I would say even randomly, based on what that government official had for breakfast that day, or he likes one group more than another, then that's not my problem. That's the government's problem if they want to enforce that. So right now, what I have heard over and over again, and especially in the Jewish response to these attacks made in the New York Times about the different Jewish schools is that if you look at the state of the public school systems in many of these areas, they are failing in all of the same areas that these articles are claiming that the Jewish schools are failing in. Sometimes even more miserably, in terms of the benchmarks of the No Child Left Behind Act, or even going further back to, you know, certain knowledge of English, math, etc. The public schools, and you can ask, I've asked, I know, we have people in our community who have been teachers in the public schools. What's going on in here in Cleveland, and then in before that in other places, public schools are failing entirely. I know this is called, in the world of argument, whataboutism. And I understand that could be a claim like, look, if I'm saying you're doing something wrong, don't throw what about him. But the fact is, when you're dealing with schools, it's very much what about him. Because if it's a matter of universal standards across our state or across the country, because there's a federal Department of Education, well then, if you're picking on me because you have an issue with my particular community and the nature and the degree of our Jewish community or some parts of the Jewish community's cultural insularity, then pick on everyone. And if you don't, and you've decided to pick on me, I don't need to submit to that. If you want to give me grief, then the Rambam says you have the halakhic right to give me grief and I'll have to pay the penalty. But the grief is clearly directed in my direction and not in other directions. Another application of this, and this clearly happened, and this is where I think the COVID regulators lost America. It was during the summer of 2020, and you had the Black Lives Matter protests all over the country for very understandable, valid reasons. I understand all of that. And I don't, so much so, I don't even want to speak about it right now. All I want to speak about is that these protests were taking place. You had gatherings of tens and hundreds of thousands of people, depending on which community. It went everywhere from hundreds of people to thousands of people to tens of thousands of people, depending on the jurisdiction. And no one was wearing masks. And no one was this. And no one was that. And what happened? The government made a decision. This isn't worth our time. They're doing this for a valid reason. And then they let it go. And lo and behold, thousands of protesters did not die. And people noticed this. I'm sure people caught COVID and so on. But the point is, there was not a mass plague that occurred when after 4 months of COVID regulations, you had thousands of people gathering together with minimal negative outcome from the medical perspective. Or so it seemed, clearly. So now the issue is, can you have a shul open and operating? No, that's wrong. Really? Across the street, they were fighting, they were protesting this. That's valid. So, you know, civil rights for blacks, police brutality is certainly a valid cause. But medically, it's entirely irrelevant, right? Meaning, the validity of the cause has nothing to do with the medical situation. I consider davening with a minyan to be a valid cause. I consider having my schools open to be a valid cause. So you're being capricious about it. If you're being capricious about it, that's not my problem. You might make it my problem, but it's not my problem like I have to quake in my boots. Dina de Malchus Adina. They're playing games. There was a shul that was operating out of a house. The shul had a Hachnasa Sefer Torah. Who was invited to the Hachnasa Sefer Torah? Many people. Who showed up at the Hachnasa Sefer Torah? The mayor of the city. And the mayor of the city came into the shul. And he went to the basement. And he was dancing, celebrating the Simchas HaTorah of one of the Jewish communities in his city. And then it was time to run for re-election. And people were saying he was too soft on the Jews. So now, there's a fine, and there's a thing, and there's a notice, and then there's a phone call, and there's a this and a that. Dina de Malchusa Dina is great, but don't play games. And if you do play games, that's on you. So this is the nature of Dina Malchusa Dina that you have to always appreciate regardless of the issue. You want medical issue, educational issues, worship issues, all of these come into play. This is one very important application of Dina Malchusa Dina. Now, when it comes to the nature of the cultural insularity, that's sort of like the second question that's suggested there, is that the government is upset because the government sees that it has a state interest in making sure that its citizens are well-educated. This has been the case, you know, certainly in the United States for a couple of centuries. It was the case in Western Europe in many countries, then became an issue in Eastern Europe. I understand the state interest in that. One of the concerns of the state interest is that you don't want your citizenry to become the criminal element. Right? Because if you can't, like it says in Pirkei Avos, if you can't make a living, then you'll go and you'll steal from people. And okay, so let's look at the results. Let's look at the results. And I think just that sentence alone speaks for itself. So, meaning we're not. Yeah, you can say, oh, this one stole, didn't pay his taxes, whatever, things like that. But you're talking about the integrity of a society, of a civilization. Everyone understands that the integrity and the civilized nature of these communities that are being maligned by the New York Times and different parts of the New York State government, it speaks for itself on that angle. I say this as someone who personally, I myself, appreciate the fact that I received a solid secular education, and I enjoy using it, and I appreciate when I see other people with that. So I'm not saying this out of a desire that my children should know their multiplication tables. But what I'm saying is, I'm able to weigh the factors over here and understand how I think people are misusing the concepts of Dina and Malchus Adina in order to further an agenda. And I'll add, I think, and I'll close your answering your question with this. Even though these articles always bring up math and English, sometimes they'll bring up science, but usually it's about math. These people, they don't know their basic math. These people, they don't know their basic English. I get it. But it's very clear, and it's become clearer year by year, that the government does not want to stop at math and English. They will continue with other things that involve letters of the alphabet. And they will not be satisfied until they have fully conquered the alphabet. Not just that I know my ABCs, but I know my other order of the alphabet. And that is something that Frum Jews feel, they see it's coming around the corner. It's here. It's past the corner. It's despite an interesting ruling by the Supreme Court, last week. This is going to come up.
Other orders of the alphabet. What do you mean?
All right.
I would never have thought of that.
All right. Good. So now, I've taken this. It's a little late. People want to leave, they can leave, but I'm still open if anyone has any other questions.
I have a question.
Phil?
So this is based on an extra grind, of course, the best kind. So I was in a shul, and I was my father in the first year, and I was supposed to be davening for the hour. Fine. So I went up to daven, and I had my baseball cap on. And they said, you can't wear a baseball cap, you have to wear a black hat. So first of all, where does it come from that you have to wear a black hat to lead the davening? And where does this come from, in any case, the mode of dress among the yeshivish world of the black hat, the black pants, the white shirt, and especially the hat, because that one makes the least sense to me. I mean, I wear a black hat on Shabbos because I like the way it looks, but I would like to know where that comes from. What's kind of the history behind the mode of dress, and what is the importance of it, the level of importance of it?
The question was, I don't know if it reached the recorder, there are shuls that have standards for how they expect their bali tefillah, their shliach tzibur to dress for whenever they daven. I haven't been in that many shuls, but you know, I'm here and there in New York and other places. I've seen over the years, shuls and yeshivas have various rules for how they expect their bali tefillah to daven. They have they range from one shul I daven at in New York, in Brooklyn. It's one of those minion factories, Landau's. There was a sign up near the amud that says that the bal tefillah, the chazan, is expected to wear a hat, a jacket, and a gartel. A gartel too, right? That's that black.
It's a Hasidic place.
It's a Hasidic place, but whoever you are, they have one minion after another. Even if you're not Hasidic, you go up there just as much as you're expected to daven the nusach of the shul, which in that shul is, of course, nusach svard, but you wear a hat, jacket, and gartel. Other shuls have lesser rules. I remember once I davened in a square shul in Montreal. When I was a bacher, I got to know one of the sofrim of the community who got me my pair of tefillin, and I got to know him. He was a very nice fellow with a large family, but he invited me to spend Shabbos with the Sagar community in Montreal. And they gave me an aliyah Shabbos morning. So they gave me the aliyah Shabbos morning. I didn't have a gartel. I didn't wear a gartel at the time, but someone lent me his gartel and his big, you know, chassidishe with the big atara talis, because I didn't have a hat. Had been at the time, I wasn't even wearing a hat. I had, I got my black hat a little later, but the big talis with the silver, you know, crown, atara, and you know, I got the aliyah that way because that is the kavod of the tzibur. That is the way that they dress. Then you have, well, at least wear a black hat, you know, and so on. Or different communities have different standards. It all goes to a Gemara. The Gemara says, it doesn't talk about black hat, of course, but it does talk about a belt, like a special belt, which probably nowadays we would refer to as a sash, which was a garment of honor that they wore, thicker than just a regular belt. You wear the sash, and the reason is because there's a pasuk in Navi that says, Hikon likras elokecha, prepare to meet your God. We would now say, prepare to meet your maker. Well, there the language was prepare to meet your God, which means if you're going to be meeting your God, then prepare. Dress the part. Dress appropriately. Dress in big day kavod. Hishtachavu Lashem b'hadras kodesh, we say in Hodu. Bow down to God in holy splendor, which means you have to dress appropriately. This is codified in Shulchan Aruch. In fact, not only is it codified in Shulchan Aruch, the language that is used in Shulchan Aruch to describe the requirement to dress appropriately to meet your God uses stronger language than the language used by Shulchan Aruch to describe the needs to daven with a minyan, which has led Rabbi Heineman in Baltimore to say, and this is quite a psak, but I've heard others who are passing this way as well, that if you have a choice, if a man has a choice, whether to daven with a minion or to go get his, as we say in yeshivash, hat and jacket, and even though getting his hat and jacket will mean he will miss the minion, it's better to wear the hat and jacket. Now, I had someone come over to me and say, in slightly more polite words than I'm about to say, but this is clearly what he meant, that's the most ridiculous thing I have ever heard. Hat and jacket? Did Moshe Rabbeinu have a hat and jacket? Leave aside the old yeshivish joke that how do you know Moshe Rabbeinu wore a shtreimel? Because the Torah says, Vayelech Moshe. Moshe went out. Would Moshe walk outside without wearing a shtreimel? You know, so that's the joke. It's an old joke. But I'll tell you, Moshe Rabbeinu did not wear a shtreimel. However, Moshe Rabbeinu wore whatever he wore to demonstrate, according to the fashion standards of 3,300 years ago, a proper kavod before addressing Hashem. And that kavod changes with the generation's fashions. And fashions change generation after generation, century after century. So you can't pinpoint one particular manner. However, there's one thing I can say, which is that whatever the standards of proper dress are, when addressing someone of importance of some kind, whether a king or just someone deserving of some form of respect, then that is the standard that Jews will use to determine how they should daven. The second thing that is important to realize, and this goes with it, is that Jews are naturally, the from Jewish community for all the centuries, is naturally conservative, small c conservative, meaning they don't change their mode of dress the moment everyone else does. Meaning if there is a mode of dress that we have become comfortable with and that we have worn, even if, what's that guy's name? I don't know. Calvin Klein decides that for summer 2023, hats are out, sashes are in, we're not throwing our hats in the garbage. Meaning we have a conservative sensibility that if there's a way that we have been doing things over the last 20 years, 50 years, we'll keep on doing it. It might slowly change organically simply because those things will not be sold in the stores anymore because they stopped them. So you have to wear something else. But that conservative trend in clothing and in fashion is something that is paired together with the idea that we dress appropriately. So for the current American model, the yeshivish model of black hat and jacket, and for those, let's say, in kollel, the rabbis, you know, a tie. Yeshiva bavim tend not to wear ties. In Israel, ties are also not the fashion, even among many of the Rosh Yeshiva. But what happened was that when the bulk of the yeshiva community came to the United States in the immediate pre-war and then post-war period, the manner of dress that was considered kavod, hikon, which is like the word hachana, prepare. Hikon l'kras alakacha was the fedora, the black fedora, and wearing this kind of jacket or blazer. That was the standard. Every yeshiva bachur knows that JFK killed the hat when he appeared at his inauguration not wearing a hat. There are interesting reasons for that, by the way. I heard once that the reason hats became less, went out of fashion, is when cars became popular. Hats were more necessary when you had to get everywhere either by walking or walking to the bus or the train or the trolley or so on. Once you're going right into your car to go somewhere, if you have a hat, you know that hats are a pain in a car if you're above a certain height, so you just take off your hat when you enter the car. So that could be one of the reasons why hats, it's not all JFK's fault, but it's that's one of the reasons why they went out of fashion. But we don't throw it away. We don't throw the hat away. It's still because of the conservative tendency, that's the second thing. That's why they're still worn. There is a place in the Mishnah Berurah where he almost suggests that from a strictly halachic point of view, because he explains, he says, in a place, we who are in a place where hats are a sign of general societal respect, so you should wear a hat when you daven. I remember learning this as a bacher, and I said, aha, that means you don't have to wear a hat, because people don't wear hats anymore. So from a strictly halachic point of view, that Mishnah Berurah does bring up a good point. However, because of the general conservatism that comes with mode of dress, that's why the hats are worn. By the way, which goes all the way back to Strimals too. You can go back to Strimals. Everyone knows Strimals was a mode of dress for the Polish nobility in the 1500s and 1600s. However, long after Polish noblemen stopped wearing Strimals, Jewish nobility, or when you wanted to be noble, like on Shabbos or Yom Tov, continued to wear Strimals. And that's how, it continues in that manner. So I hope that addresses your point. Wait, just Joel, do I have a follow-up?
Wasn't hats popular for cold injury and...
Yes, for a more, depending on this, on the event, the hats would change. And I remember in yeshiva this was clear, that there was a certain type, there were top hats that were worn, or there's a style of hat known as the Homburg, which doesn't have the brim go down, but it stays up. It's like a solid brim all around. You can't even pinch the bottom of it to go down. Different styles that people would wear if they didn't during the week. This kind of hat, and on Shabbos, that kind of hat.
It's not
It's a, right, of greater formality, depending on the occasion. I davened at the Spanish-Portuguese shul in Montreal about 20 years ago. And on Shabbos, the officers of the shul, the president, vice president, who sit on the dais, like up there, wore a top hat and a Prince Albert jacket, which is a form of kapota, and striped pants. I'm not expecting that to, you know, here, but the point is, they had an appreciation of the way that it was done back in Amsterdam, and this is what Spanish Portuguese means.
I hope that was only in the morning, because otherwise that's a full
body. Yeah, absolutely. Only Shabbos Shachris. Yes, only, yes.
I was just considering what happened with Phil. During the year of Abel, he's supposed to be given the opportunity to daven at the Amor as much as possible to say Kaddish. So shouldn't they offer him like a hat or something?
And they did. They had a workaround. It said that you could either, well, when do I have, and they did that once, it was this big. Uh-huh. Or they put a talus over your, you wear a talus, put a talus
right
over your head.
Okay,
so they didn't give it, there was an alternative.
Yeah.
I have seen shuls, Phil said it happened to him, and I was going to say the same thing. Like, for example, this shul, somebody asked me to daven for the Amud this when I was in Brooklyn, you know, whenever it was. And the sign said you have to wear a gartel, but there was a gartel at the Amud, because they expected that sometimes people want to daven there.
But am I correct about him davening at the Amud?
Yes.
However, a shul has the right to set its policies for its kavod. Meaning there is an idea that above and beyond, or I should say before, any other standard of what a chazan is expected to do, is that he be, and we actually use this phrase in the Hineni, if you look before Musaf on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, that you have to be merutza lekahal, me'urav im habrios, fit in, liked and beloved by the congregation. That's rule number one. You can have all the chiyuvim in the world. If it's going to generate anger or animosity of any kind, then that comes first. You know, because the person is the shaliach tzibur, right? Literally, right? All right. Any other questions? Okay. Well, these have been some wonderful questions. I want to thank you all for them. And I'd like to do this more often. Someone was listening to the recording of the last one, said they'd like to see it more often, and I'm in agreement. So we'll end there for now. I want to thank Dr. Katz, I want to thank Phil for sponsoring this in memory of their fathers. And we will bench shortly.
Your phone rang in the middle, so I don't know if it